Hi there, my name is Saul and you are listening to a podcast dedicated to telling the story of London, the city's rich and diverse history as it winds its way through time, a chronological narrative of this place and the people within it. And right now, the story is deep in the medieval era of the city. It's about as medieval as it gets. So King Richard II rules England, in name only. He had just experienced a damn close coup d'etat attempt by a group of men called the Knights Appellant. They were five big nobles who were effectively running the country whether the king liked it or not. They were led by Thomas of Woodstock, aka the Duke of Gloucester, the king's uncle and son of the late great Edward III. With him were Richard Fitzalan, the Earl of Arundel, and Thomas de Beauchamp, the Earl of Warwick. Alongside these three big nobles, two more had joined this cabal: Thomas de Mowbray, the Earl of Nottingham, and Henry of Bolingbroke, the king's cousin, the Earl of Derby, and the offspring of the eldest surviving son of Edward III, a man called John of Gaunt, who was currently over in Spain fighting for the crown of Castilia, while the king was being curtailed by these five dudes. This whole event was to have a profound impact upon the young king, but just not yet. Meanwhile, in London, a period of intense political infighting had just come to an end and had ushered in a whole new era. In 1388, a new place of execution had been designated to deal with the fate of the city's former mayor, Sir Nicholas Brembe. Brembe's story we covered a lot over the last 10 chapters, and I'm not inclined to go over it again, but going forward we should mention that he was killed at a new location for the gallows, which was erected at the manor of St. Marylebone, aka in local slang, Tyburn, which was just outside the medieval city on the corner of today's Oxford Street and Edgware Road. It's not clear why this site was chosen. Most executions were usually conducted in locations outside of the walls of the city, like the Elms of Smithfield, the confines of Tower Hill, or the precincts of the jail on Newgate. However, this is the first time we are pretty sure that Tyburn was ever used. Nicholas Brembe had been brutally hung and eviscerated in Tyburn for his involvement with the king, at the behest of these five Lords Appellant, but also with the collusion of many of his former allies back in London. His execution in Tyburn had been a brutal thing, but it was not the only high-profile death of those who supported the king that year. The story goes, and it is a story, that the Cornishman Lord Chief Justice Sir Robert Treslian, who had also been condemned alongside Brembe, had fled when he heard the charges of treason were being laid against him. But he had not fled far. He had sought and gained sanctuary in Westminster Abbey, just round the corner from London. On the 13th of February 1388, he was seen trying to see what was happening in court. Having already been tried in absentia, a London mob descended upon him, seized him, and brought him before the king's court, screaming, "We have him, we have him." Already convicted, the Cornishman was stripped naked, taken to Tyburn, and there was hung before having his throat cut. This is London in the medieval era. A turbulent city, and it was about to get much worse. And then surprisingly better. And then grimly way worse. It's a city of spectacle and pageantry, of politics and passion, of people just trying to make their way through life in a brutal era. This week we cover the amazing story of an international joust that took place on London Bridge itself, how and why all the political factions of London seemed about ready to restart all their own shenanigans, and then why they suddenly stopped and made peace with one another, and how there briefly flourished a crime-fighting wizard upon the streets of the city. No, I'm not kidding about that one. So, it is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the 140th chapter of this story of London, the Great Wizard Detective of London Town. So, dear listener, please understand that there is a lot going on across England right now. A massive and intricate dance of politics as the Lords of Pallant held power and tried to run the country and maintain their grip while John of Gaunt was returning back to England and was seeking to reinsert himself into the political situation of the realm, and there was an incredibly intricate and convoluted process of peace talks with France that did succeed in creating the longest ceasefire in this massive multi-generational conflict, as both France and England were suffering from the incredible expenses of this war. And all of this incredible story, an amazing political saga of personalities and careful moves, which was about to see the Pallants eventually lose power and the king regain it as he suddenly comes across as an astute political operator, is a heck of a tale, one that would take many hours to even begin to do it justice. However, this is the story of London, not of England, and there's way too much going on in London to focus on this, and as such, I just need you to be aware that this is happening outside of the city. But within it, London had their own issues to deal with right now that related and reflected these national concerns, but were much more focused to the politics of the street. The death of Brembe had shocked the city. The man who had been mayor 4 times was dead, killed so swiftly and brutally via rather convoluted legal means, that it really put the city on alert. Anyone can fall. The purge of the king's followers, done so brutally, gave clear notice to the city that the Lords of Pallant were the ones very much in charge. London had turned on Brembe in the end out of self-preservation. The current mayor and his supporters were now desperate to remain in the grace and favour of the Lords of Pallant. Mayor Exton petitioned for a general pardon for London for any treasonable actions they may be accused of from the beginning of Brembe's mayoralty in 1382 up until May 1388. He asked for this pardon while also making sure the likes of John de Northampton, Moore and Norbury were to be excluded. This way the city could be forgiven and Exton could keep his hated political rival still in jail. It's probable this was the only price he demanded of the Lords of Pallant for his support in consenting to Brembe's death. In the aftermath of Brembe's execution, the fishmongers and the grocers closed ranks and began planning for a way forward. They had a great political cause that allowed them to unite, returning the wool staple from Middleburg in Holland to Calais in France. A mandatory wool market in Calais would not only see them return to the money-making ways of the past, it would also undermine their rivals in the mercers and the drapers, who were only now really getting the benefits of a staple over in Middleburg, and would, they hoped, please the Lord of Pallant. You see, the Lords of Pallant wanted to actively prosecute the war with France, and a strong garrison in Calais was crucial to this. The argument went that having a wool staple in Calais run by London grocers would provide the funds to maintain the garrison in Calais. And to sweeten the deal, the mayor, Exton, had the city give the new Pallant government £5,000, while both he and the grocer William Venner also led substantial amounts of money to them personally. However, this ploy did not work as they hoped. The five lords in question were not dumb. Their reply to all of this was that with the consent of Parliament, the Pallants would move the staple to Calais or to England, whichever seemed the more profitable decision to make at the time. London's merchants got worried. Inevitably, this deepened the animosity between the established wool exporters and those cloth exporters, clearly manifested in the drapers and mercers' companies, who saw their best interests served by keeping the staple at Middleburg. And as such, the drapers and mercers began agitating and the politics in London swung towards them. In March 1388, we see the election of John de Northampton's old followers, Tyford, Francis, Carleton and Bam, to the court of aldermen, alongside 3 drapers and 5 mercers. This meant that the grocers and fishmongers had ceased to dominate the city's government, and Mayor Exton could expect his own authority to be undermined. The mercers had already shown in their petition against Brembe, they were very eager to build an alliance with the Lords of Pallant. The old factional politics of London seemed to be about ready to start up again. These divisions were given an added bitterness by one of the final acts of the merciless parliament that had condemned so many of the king's followers to death. It reimposed the Statute of York in its entirety. That was an old law that gave complete freedom to trade to Londoners and non-London residents within the city, with no exception being made for the liberties of London. The intrigues and vicious attempts to remove all victuallers from the city politics had really just given the rural landowners and the rest of the country a chance to curtail London's powerful trade concessions. This probably explains the overall sense of utter frustration and anger towards the aldermen of the city. By their political infighting, they'd screwed over things. And we see this frustration in a series of complaints brought before the mayor that year. For example, one of my favourites, quote, John Wellcott, alderman of the ward of Walbrook, came before Nicholas Exton, mayor of the City of London, unquote. And the alderman was deeply upset because, quote, on the Thursday before, he ordered the reputable men of his ward to be summoned by Robert Parker, bailiff of the ward, to appear before him in order to advise him as to diverse matters touching on our Lord the King and the city aforesaid. He sent the said bailiff to the house of Robert Stafferton, who thereupon made answer that he had nothing whatsoever to say to him, and that he would not come to him. Whereupon the bailiff asked him again to come to the said alderman, to which he made the reply that he wished the alderman himself had come to him, that he might have kissed his rearward, and so he altogether refused to appear before the same alderman, unquote. I love this. The alderman summoned being refused by Robert Stafferton, who openly said he could come kiss his ass. The response to this, however, quote, for such unbecoming words, so uttered, the mayor sent the said Robert Stafferton to prison, there to remain until he shall take in counsel with the other aldermen of the city, so as to give judgment on his behalf, unquote. Over Easter, Stafferton admitted that he said what he said, and the mayor and the alderman sat in judgment, and it was eventually decreed that he, quote, should be taken from the prison to his house, aforesaid, and from the same house, between the 8th and 9th hour, before dinner, with his head uncovered, and attended by an officer of the city, should carry a lighted wax candle weighing 2 pounds, through Walbrook, Breconsbury, and so to the Conduit and Cheap, to St. Lawrence Lane in Old Jewry, and along that lane to the chapel of the Guildhall aforesaid, and there make offering of said wax candle, which done, all further imprisonment was to be remitted unto him and forgiven, unquote. So yeah, a weird bit of public humiliation for saying he wanted the alderman to kiss his ass. Who says London's politics is not petty? But there were darker insults taking place. One case arrived before the mayor was that experienced by, quote, William Wotton, alderman of the ward of Dowgate, on Saturday the eve of Pentecost, unquote. Alderman Wotton apparently, quote, went to the shambles of St. Nicholas in London, and seeing diverse pieces of meat lying for sale at the shambles there of Richard Bowle, butcher, asked the said Richard at what price he sold the same, to which he made answer that 4 shillings was the price. Whereupon the alderman said the meat was too dear, to which the said Richard made reply, I do verily believe that the meat is too dear for thee, who I suppose never bought as much meat as that for thine own use. And whereupon the said Richard, immediately observing that William aforesaid was wearing the hood of an alderman's pattern, said, art thou an alderman? To which the other answered, yea, why askest thou? Whereupon he said, it is a good thing for thee and thy fellows, the aldermen, to be so wise and wary, but to make light of riding on the pavement, as some among ye have been doing. For which words so uttered, upon plaint made by the alderman aforesaid, the said Richard, by precept of Nicholas Exton, the mayor, was committed to the prison of Newgate, there to remain until the mayor and alderman should have taken counsel as to pronouncing judgment thereon, unquote. Yeah, he was basically saying, you guys, aldermen, you're walking the streets as if nothing could happen to you. That's brave. It was a threat. And on the 25th of May, 1388, the butcher was dragged before the courts and given 6 months in Newgate prison. A petition from his fellow butchers got that remitted down to a single day, but the butcher also had to carry a great big heavy candle through the streets in an act of public contrition. So yeah, there was definitely a change in the atmosphere towards the aldermen. But behind the threats and complaints lay the hint of politics and political rows. We know the Lords Appellant decided to summon Parliament away from London, not in Westminster, but in Barnwell Priory near Cambridge, for that September. And that meant four MPs had to be chosen. And this triggered another struggle between the rival groups in London. The Drapers and the Skinners notably increased their representation in the large Common Council, which was summoned to elect two of the members of the Commons. The Grocers, though, managed to hold on to a significant number. But as it had been for many years, the city was divided. The aldermen actually elected members of the two opposing factions. So you had one of Northampton's followers, Adam Bam, going as MP, and Brembe's brother-in-law, the vintner Henry Vanner, going as the other. But these two MPs of London reflected the divisions in the city, and apparently there were insults offered to Bam by one of William Venner's servants, supposedly, quote, by many disgraceful and bad words in the King's Highway in the presence of many bystanders, had abused the said alderman, unquote. And around the same time, an officer in Cornhill Ward had been arrested for saying that, quote, he had heard a person say that the same John Churchman and Hugh had been arrested by the Council of the Lord the King, and had been sent upon two horses with their hands tied behind them to the Tower of London, and further that the Duke of Gloucester with a club had broken the head of said John Churchman, unquote. This was a time of rumour and speculation, of snide comments, of passive-aggressive ways of speaking, of a building political argument. The rumour went out that the mayor had tried to get Robert Knowles, an old ally and business partner of his, appointed captain or military governor of the city. We get the impression of once again London being reduced to a febrile and angry place, seething in resentment and strong political opinion. However, with Parliament now sitting a safe distance from this atmosphere, the appellants continued to pursue their policy of satisfying the landed interests at the expense of the towns. They passed a bunch of very savage labour laws, which were designed to curtail the powers of the town. They passed an ordinance forbidding labourers to apprentice their children to crafts or trades. More important for the grocers was the renewal of the statute, which prohibited victuallers from holding any judicial or civic office in London or any other town. And another blow was the suppression of all the guilds and fraternities, with the exceptions of those which had either purely a religious purpose or were licensed by the king. The object of all these laws was to either destroy the means by which townspeople had combined to protect their economic interests, or to make them regain their interests, provided they paid heavily for it. The Lords Appellant's policy towards London seems to have been that of divide and rule, and to encourage the instability. They supported Exton in his denial that he had sought to make Robert Knowles captain of the city, and for military reasons, they then promised to move the staple to Calais. But that October, it seemed they brought pressure to the city to elect Northampton's associate, the goldsmith, Nicholas Tyford, as mayor. This man who, as we covered in chapter 137, had been opposed last time he looked like he was going to become mayor by an armed mob hidden inside of Guildhall by Nicholas Brembe. One source at the time suggests the goldsmith gained this position after promising to remove all the victuallers from office in the city. The time of Mayor Tyford saw an immediate retreat to safety by many of his opponents. Exton found it necessary to obtain himself a personal pardon for, you know, any treasons or felonies he might have committed, and so too did the grocer, William Venner. The Lord Appellant's keenness to support the goldsmith may have been a consequence of the faltering financial support from London given to them over the last few months when they were encouraging, well, nonsense to happen. The city had given no corporate loans after that of March 1388, and those given by individual merchants steadily diminished in number and size over the following months. I have to say, the actual main reason why money was not being lent out as much from London was nothing to do with all the political chaos going on. It was more to do with the fact that the output of the mint in the Tower of London after 1389 was reduced enormously, and this hindered trade by restricting the credit which merchants could rely upon. from 1391 to 1397, we're going to see very little silver being struck there, and the number of gold coins issued fell by two-thirds. This dramatic reduction in the supply of coin was most serious because it was essential for the retail trade. And so, yeah, be aware, London is walking into one hell of a recession in the next decade. Mayor Tyford was most likely back to become mayor, either to produce fresh corporate loans from the city by his own exhortations, or, in the tradition of John de Northampton, to make life so bloody uncomfortable for the grocers that they would again seek to buy the apparent support. One of the measures Tyford took, which was obviously designed to prevent the staplers from recovering their old domination, was the passing of an ordinance which prevented any mayor in future from holding office more than once in 5 years. There were to be no more mayors like Nicholas Brembe. However, out beyond London, there was a huge political shift in the power of the land. The king, now in his 20s, seemed to regain his political mojo. There are long and convoluted reasons for this. Richard II was coming into his own politically. By 1389, this process was ongoing. The wool staple had returned to Calais on the 3rd of February, with the Londoner, John Churchman, as its mayor. Within 3 months of this, the king, now in his 22nd year, reasserted his right to rule and deprived the appellants of the power they had assumed back in their near coup d'etat. The surrender of power by these lords was basically down to the impending return of the Duke of Lancaster, who landed in England the following November. John of Gaunt was weary. He had failed to take the throne of Castile. He tried to make himself the overlord of Gascony, but while he'd gained some successes, he was getting on. He wanted to secure his lands in Lancaster. He returned to help his nephew, the king, restore statesmanship and compromise to the conduct of government and God's rightful ruler in charge of his land. But at least, with this going on, the wool staple was back in Calais. And this sorted everything, right? Well, of course not. Because immediately this had caused tension back in London between those who wanted the wool staple in Calais and the mercers and the drapers who had enjoyed the staple being over in Holland. The return of the Calais staple, therefore, helped to perpetuate the old alliance of mercers, drapers and goldsmiths that had supported Northampton back in the day. In October 1389, they conspired to support the goldsmith Adam Bam as their candidate in the upcoming mayoral elections. And the other side put forward the grocer, William Venner. It was just like old times, guild against guild over who would be mayor. Even the contemporaries said this was no different from the era of John de Northampton and Nicholas Brembe. In the end, the grocer William Venner won and was made mayor. Nevertheless, on the very day that the staple returned to Calais, 13 London merchants had received from Duke Albert of Holland a license to trade freely in his territories for another 2.5 years, renewable after that. This group included 3 prominent mercers, a fuller, but also 5 grocers. These were members of a younger generation of grocers who joined the company after 1386, and they were less committed than their elders to the wool trade. Things were beginning to change. There is evidence that even after the staple moved to Calais, product was still being taken to Middleborough, and these grocers were now importing wax, canvas, soap and almonds from Holland. And a deal was made that non-London drapers could buy their cloth to sell in London and could do so at 3 appointed places. The stocks at Cheapside, at the house of the grocer John Young, who lived near the Church of St. Atheline, and at a house formerly owned by John Aubrey, also opposite the churchyard of St. Atheline. It looked like provincial drapers were expected at this time to sell their cloth to the grocers of Soper's Lane. So, same as it ever was. No, not quite. This is, as I said, significant of a change coming. But before that change hit, the splendour and pageantry of London carried on regardless of its politics. 1389 sees a significant change in the life of one Londoner. Geoffrey Chaucer, that full-time civil servant and part-time poet, was suddenly made the clerk of the King's Works, succeeding the mason and architect Henry Yeovilly. Fortunately for Chaucer, he was allowed to appoint a deputy because he was in over his head. His new responsibilities included the maintenance and the development of the Tower of London, the Palace of Westminster, the King's Manors of Eltham, Kennington and Shane, and the mews at Charing Cross where the King kept his falcons. Chaucer appears to have only held the post for 2 years. And then came January 1390. And something happened that completely changed the entire political situation in London. The Parliament of 1390 saw rural MPs petition the King, growing in power now, that it would be better for everyone who are not from London if the wool staples all returned to England. And that way the King could gather shedloads of cash from the foreigners. The King came to believe that home staples would increase government revenues, and so he agreed that January to bring them back in, postponing the introduction to do all right till the end of the year. The Italians seemed especially delighted, and Italian merchants began increasing their imports to their preferred marketplace. And yes, looks like Southampton was back on the menu, boys. The grocer mayor, William Venner, now realised that London had a year to unify itself, bring together all the disparate factions, and charm the pants out of the King, and get everyone to change their mind. He looked at his rivals, and they saw that with their staples all being returned to England, they're going to be out of profit. Suddenly, enemies realised they should become friends. William Venner had been a young merchant in 1369 and had seen firsthand of what the home staple idea would do on his trade and the economy of London. In the face of this renewed threat, it was essential to him that the factional conflict which had nearly prevented his election as mayor should end. And that year saw a massive rapprochement as all the former opponents, well, started to kiss and make up. The grocer mayor chose a mercer as one of his sheriffs. The election as a member of the Commons of John Hadley, by now generally recognised as the city's elder and most able statesman, gave them a faint hope that he may be able to persuade the Parliament to change its mind. And in October, in the most conciliatory gesture of them all, the grocers and the other staplers all helped to elect their old opponent, the goldsmith Adam Bam, as mayor. And then to add icing on this cake of unity, Venner then courted the Duke of Lancaster. In the previous July, the Duke, true to his sense of obligation, had renewed his appeals for the full restoration of John de Northampton to the freedom of the city and to revoke all the judgments that had been laid upon him. Mayor Venner now lent his support to this fully, and Northampton and his associates were reinstated to the freedom of the city, to which they had once been blamed for causing nothing but riots and conflicts in. There was no triumphant return for them. They come back to a political stage very different from the one which had given them power. The conflicts of interest between the wool and cloth merchants, which Northampton had been part of, were over in the face of changes in the structure of the European economy. For the grocers, the mercers, and the drapers, and everyone else, the Italians were now the common enemy. And the lack of coin meant that economic recession was the greatest threat to the liberties of the city. In the spring of 1391, the mayor, Adam Bam, made a solemn proclamation forbidding anyone to speak ill of Brembe or Northampton. And this marked the end of an era. The proclamation was in fact a validation of his efforts to create a common political front amongst the city's disparate groups. London was finally united after over a decade of political strife and intrigue and conflict. Indeed, the mayor ended the long drawn-out feud with the Duke of Lancaster. 1390 was a year where London was trying to put on a good face, uniting to condemn public health issues, like the one we see in the records that says, quote, "Seeing that many salted fish called pikes, stinking and rotten, and an abomination to the people, were carted and thrown into a certain well near Welcus Burns, without city, by reason of which so great a stench arose that the people passing were greatly offended thereby, to the great scandal of the citizens of the city," unquote, that they got their heads together and investigated to find who was dumping all this stuff. And not only did they discover who was dumping rotten fish into a well near Cripplegate, but they also discovered they were selling other rotten fish to the public, and they fined them. And when they were not doing that, the city was punishing two men called John Pertneys and John Mackinton, who were convicted of breaking into houses, including one of a mercer, and they hung them. And around now, there was an extraordinary moment in London's history that highlights, for me, the wonder of the medieval city perfectly. Our London records say that there was a court case brought against one John Birking, quote, who was lately a Jew, as he said, and was attached to make answer in a plea of falsehood and deceit, unquote. Now, why Birking was brought before the court accused of falsehood and deceit was to do with the case of a man called William Shadewater, who was a sergeant in the employment of the Duke of York. It turned out that a few weeks before, quote, two silver dishes belonging to the said Duke had been stolen from his dwelling house in the parish of St. Bridget in Fleet Street in the suburb of London, unquote. And as a result, someone approached this John Birking and, quote, asked the same John if he could tell by his magic art, in which art he was skilled, as it was said, what had become of such dishes, and who had stolen them. Which John thereupon, as saying he well understood incantations and the art magic, made answer to them that he was very well able to say where the said dishes were, and who had stolen them. And then he falsely and maliciously asserted that the said William had stolen them, owing to the which he was arrested and imprisoned, and his body was much injured, and on the point of being forced to swear that he would never come within 10 leagues of the hostels of our lord the king, the Duke of York aforesaid, or the Duke of Gloucester, to the great slander of his name, and to the grievous damage of his body, unquote. Yep, John Birking was a wizard who solved crime, and seems to have had a reputation already, so that he was able to be hired by the staff working for the Duke of York, and had said that this William Shadewater was the person who had done it. Having condemned this one man for theft, our soothsayer was on a roll, and the complaints about him then said, quote, Robert Maysdean and John Gaty severally made plaint against the same John Birking for that, whereas a scarlet mantle of Lady Le Despenser, with fur of Clens Minerva, had been stolen from the hostel of that lady in the parish of St. Maisie Bothane in London on the 18th day of January in the year aforesaid, the same John Birking, pretending that he knew who had stolen it, whereas he had falsely and maliciously lied therein, said that the aforesaid Robert and John Gaty had stolen it, through which they were arrested and imprisoned and suffered each of them very great injury in his body, and were on the point of being forced to swear and form before mentioned to the great slander as well as the name of each of them, unquote. The career of the great wizard detective, John Birking, seems to have been well established. But these three complainants ended up before the authorities, and he was dragged before the authorities, and, quote, the same John was severely questioned before the mayor and the alderman in the chamber of the Guildhall at the suit of each of these persons, who thereupon acknowledged that the falsehood and deceit aforesaid had been committed by him, and that he had falsely and maliciously defamed the said William, Robert and John Gaty, as to which he begged for mercy, unquote. Ah, our great wizard detective, turns out he didn't know magic. He was just making it up. Who would have thought? His career now in tatters, and at his later hearing, quote, upon which day, by assent of the mayor and alderman, deliberation having been held thereon, because that such soothsaying, art, magic, and falsities are manifestly against the doctrine of Holy Writ, and a scandal and disgrace to the whole commonality of the city, and through such doings murders might easily ensue, and good and lawful men might be undeservedly aggrieved and defamed in their name and reputation, it was awarded that the said John should on the same day be put on the pillory at Cornhill, there to stand for 1 hour of the day, and afterwards they were to take him back to prison, unquote. Apparently, he was held until the 19th of March, and then he swore he would never practice magic again, and he would leave the city. Ah, magical detective's career only lasted a few months, but it was a wonderful story. And 1390 actually had an even better story than that, and the events that led to this began far to the north, up in Scotland. I've missed an entire section of English history here, people, where Scotland and England had been at war with one another over the last few years, and there were long and convoluted peace talks going on. I missed it because it had nothing to do with London. But what we do know is that according to the records, during these convoluted peace talks, but before peace had actually been established, one of the English diplomats to Scotland, Sir John Wells, aka the 5th Baron Wells, had a little bit too much to drink in Edinburgh. Now, Wells was a bit of a champion jouster, and he got into a bit of an argument with somebody called David Lindsay, who would later become the first Earl of Crawford. And he also was a champion jouster. And, well, to cut a long story short, they were obviously talking about who was best, because Sir John Wells supposedly said, quote, "Let words have no place. If ye know not the chivalry and valiant deeds of Englishmen, appoint me a day and a place where ye list, then ye shall have experience," unquote. Oh yes, a challenge was issued, a joust. Wells was brilliant and so was Lindsay, and it transpired the two men would have a duel over a joust. Now, given the nations were at war with one another, there had to be negotiations which were needed to allow the Scotsmen travel south with a party to partake in the joust. And while that was going on, and it was also decided that the joust should happen in London. Now, we know a lot about the preparation that went into the said tournament and joust. London records say an order was sent out to the aldermen of the city, instructing them, quote, "For the safekeeping and maintenance of the peace of our lord the king, and for saving the honour of the city, we do command and charge you, strictly enjoining, that you shall order in your ward that sufficient watch shall be made by persons able for defence, well arrayed, every night during the time of the revels and jousts that are now approaching," unquote. So yeah, London was all up on making sure this joust was to go well. And then someone decided that the joust between the Scotsman and the Englishman should take place on London Bridge itself. Why you would pick this place, I have no idea. It was a confined space. Crowd control would be a problem. And the ground was solid stone. But for whatever reason, the young king insisted, we believe, and John Wells of England and Henry Lindsay of Scotland faced down at each other at opposite end of London Bridge on St. George's Day in a slightly more psychotically violent version of the Calcutta Cup. The story goes that the king and his court watched expectantly from a stand, and that thousands of Londoners tried to see this amazing spectacle on the river. The two riders rode furiously at one another, but they missed. Ah! And then they turned their horses round, picked up the lances, and they tried again. And again, no strikes were recorded. The two men regrouped, and on the third run, Wells was entirely knocked from his horse. Now, supposedly, the crowd saw both men hit by lances, but the Englishman went flying and the Scotsman remained on his horse. And all the Londoners started crying out that this was clearly a fix and that the Scotsman had, I don't know, nailed himself to his saddle. As such, the outcry was so big that Lindsay there and then decided to jump off his horse, show he was not nailed to the saddle, and then jumped back on, which is pretty impressive. It was at this point that everyone noticed, however, that John Wells had not gotten back up. I mean, he'd just been slammed off his horse at high speed and landed onto solid stone. The guy was not moving. Lindsay then leapt from his horse again, this time to offer support for his fellow knight. And you see that? Oh, that was how it's supposed to be. That's all proper chivalry-like, you know. And the crowd, which had been annoyed to see some bloody Scotsman beat their English champion on home soil, actually started to cheer the conduct of the Scottish knight. That's all proper-like, innit? The story goes that Lindsay spent 3 days by Wells' bedside nursing his opponents back to health, and that made a great reading and a great impression. And in later dates, apparently Lindsay was made the Scottish ambassador to England, and Londoners would remember him for his chivalric behaviour and spoke well of him. Still, all this pageantry and glory and glad-handing by the mayors and their unified London, unfortunately, could not change the fate of the city. In November 1390, the wool staples returned to England. It was an utter economic disaster for London. Unfortunately, it was also an economic disaster for England. You see, you'd just seen the return of the plague in England, and it had been combined that year with a bad harvest that summer, and this caused a sudden shortage of food, and the price of food shot up in London and elsewhere. No big revenues were earned by the wool staple, and believe it or not, by November 1391, the wool staple in England was dissolved and London got its Calais staple back. But recession and food shortages fell upon the city as the year wore on. London was united, at least. Well, politically, it had put behind the old passions and arguments and rows of the era of Brembe and Northampton, and it was moving forward. A new generation of leaders were coming into their own, as a king was slowly regaining power. But the home staples, like a joust on London Bridge, were ideas that seemed good at the time, but really, well, when you think about it, really a dumb thing to do. And this was a warning that London should have heeded. Richard II was about to do a whole bunch of really dumb things, and London was going to genuinely suffer from it. But we'll save that for the next episode. Thanks for listening. Nice short one there, as we move on now into the 1390s. And things shall get fun with Richard II. I hope you enjoyed it. I really did enjoy some of the stories in this, especially the joust on London Bridge, and of course, the great wizard detective of London Town. These are the moments of London life I enjoy the most, these small little snapshots of the weird and wonderful. So, but there you go, a detective wizard, years before Sherlock Holmes. I'm sure that would make a hell of a book. All right, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. This is Saul saying bye.